The time is 1:35 and the date is February 14th, 1983. The place is the Judiciary Hearing Room, Room 124 in the Capitol in Juneau. I would like at this time to remind those sitting in the gallery that there are sign-up sheets at the door. We're discussing two bills today, so there are two sheets, one for each set there. And if you indicate whether you'd like to testify today, I'd appreciate it at this time. I'd like the record to reflect that Representative Hayes and Representative Malone are absent. The rest of the committee is present. The first of the two bills under discussion today is HB 109, which is an act entitled An Act Relating to Criminal Prosecutions of Minors. The prime sponsor of the bill, Representative Pestinger, is here today to make a statement regarding the bill. And due to the press of other duties, we'd like to press him into service and make a statement right now if we could.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pestinger, as we are electronically recording this, we'll state your name for the record and proceed in a manner such as you will. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm Representative Sam Pestinger. I represent District 8. I know many of you are very busy, and I've noticed the sign-up sheet for witnesses. There are many witnesses who have signed up to give testimony, so I will try to be as brief as possible while covering the main points. It is my hope to give us an overview, just so we sense the subject matter and understand what we're dealing with. To help accomplish that understanding is my goal. Basically, I think we have a jurisdictional problem when it comes to treating juveniles, because in Colleen Anchorage, the statute does allow now for, if when the district attorney petitions a judge, there can be a determination whether or not there's a probable cause finding whether a juvenile is not amenable to the benefits of the act. Which means that right now on the books, there is a procedure that gives the judge the discretion to prosecute a juvenile as an adult, and that's very important. A judge can decide whether or not to prosecute a juvenile as an adult. I could find no case at all in Anchorage where a juvenile has been prosecuted as an adult. I believe it must have happened at some time, but I cannot think of a case where a juvenile has been prosecuted as an adult. Now, basically, the court can retain power over a juvenile until 1 year after his 18th birthday. Or the court can have power over a juvenile for a two-year period. And it's really only a two-year period. And then you have to go through a special hearing to get an additional 2 years. So basically, the court has power over a juvenile for 2 years. So if you now under this system, if you have, say, a juvenile who is 17 and a half years old, and he commits murder one, as a practical matter, he will be held in custody until he's 19. He will be released, his record may be sealed, and he's eligible for civil service. So you can have situations where you're dealing with homicide one, and where a man maybe will be incarcerated for a year. So what this bill proposes to do is to take away the court's power to determine whether a juvenile may or may not receive the benefits of the act, and it says the court shall sentence, or shall, well, in looking at the bill, I'd like to amend it to Title 12, 55, or 15. And I'd like to put an E in there. Section 1, yes, it would be 12, 55, 015, C is what we're referring to. And we recently had 12, 55, 015, D amended to refer to controlled substances, so the next letter potentially would be E. And the thrust of this is, it just says that if the minor is 16 years of age or older, that if he has committed an unclassified felony or a class A felony, that he will be prosecuted as an adult. That's the text of the bill, and I'm omitting some of them. Now, I know, and I wish the Attorney General's office to address this, and I believe it will, if you will. A problem is in the area, too, what do you do with the presumptive sentencing? That is a weakness in this bill that I have before this body. What do you do when a juvenile commits murder one, and you look at the presumptive sentencing, and you might have a 20-year mandatory minimum, so 20 to 99 years? That point needs to be addressed. I'm going through this rather quickly. I'm not, are there any questions?
Thank you very, very much. Thank you very much. Questions here with really a lot of very questions. Very, very popular, very, very well.
Are you trying to suggest that the juvenile labor procedure is better than you? Is that what you're questioning?
I know from district attorneys that they have asked judges to waive it. And I know the district attorneys that have, who have asked the judges to waive the juvenile record beyond. And I know defense attorneys have fought with the DAs on that point. And in every case I can think of, the judge has always gone with the defense attorney because he's concluded, because of tender years, that there is, that he will not make a finding that this man is not amenable to treatment under the juvenile delinquency act. So the prosecutor decides to use it, and the defense has always won on that point. This goes for an answer.
Your position is that the labor statute is not as successful as you.
It is implemented by the prosecutor and the defense attorney involved statistically to a very great extent because the judge finds, because of the tender years, he's unwilling to say that this man is not amenable to treatment. I'm thinking of a homicide in Eagle River. I believe it was Karen Purcell was beaten to death so severely that the car arm broke. And the juvenile maybe got incarcerated for a year for him. So I think for these hardcore offenders, for these heinous crimes, and that's why an unclassified crime is murder, war, and treason, heinous crimes, I don't think we should give them the protection of well, I think the bank is the case for that.
Yes, my concern is on that point. The criticism that I've heard is that the procedure is not used. I don't want to be as well as I can believe in the deal of doing. The prosecutor is coming in and the position is that it's not asking me that the exception is that you don't have to be able to say that it's not successful. You have to consider the different problems in your case. I guess I'm anxious to say that you can tell it back. To support the audience.
My first goal is to call Anchorage to talk to the people who are involved with juveniles in Anchorage and say, can you give me a case where a juvenile was prosecuted as an adult? Can you give me a case in the last 5 years? Basically, we don't keep statistics on this, but we cannot get you a case.
Who is it? Who do you ask?
No. Jay Warner, the people who... Yes.
Do we have a court official for that?
And you yourself, Representative Clarkson, have mentioned that the prosecutors have given up on it. But although they've given up on it, I can think of a recent case where Joe Evans was the defense attorney, and I don't remember if it was a homicide, but the court determined that this juvenile, they wouldn't make a finding that he couldn't be amenable to treatment under the act, so they wouldn't prosecute him as an adult. I don't think you can suggest to me one case that you know of where they have prosecuted him as an adult.
Criminal law, so I've never been through it. But that's my point, is I just simply want to determine what the problem is before we go forward in this matter. Hopefully we can find that out.
The goal is to do that, like the evidence show that the Representative Malone is very, very testimony is very, very effectual. Representative Malone does that.
First of all, I would like to comment upon probably have been the standard ways in that person of privacy as an adult, certainly ways to take the current skills in the river and the person that committed the murder that they were in one year, that is, that's what did happen. And certainly I strongly believe that if it was ever going to be moved at that time, it wouldn't. My question to you is, you have been able to send it to the river. Is this, and I haven't had a chance to check, is this the same way to that river that we have in the river?
It could be. It once again stresses the unclassified crimes and the class A felonies. I believe that was there have been many bills on this, and I look particularly at Representative Carl Anderson's bill that he pre-filed. Bills in the Senate, bills in the House, and I've tried to combine them in a basic manner without making the subject too complicated.
Thank you.
Just a
couple
other questions, because apparently we're going to be leaving. Some of you guys are going to anticipate some other testimony. Other alternatives have been talked around. Short of eliminating labor provisions that anybody wants to see. One of the proposals, which probably the best summary of it, is that in the letter from Chairman Connection around the financial position in response to some of their ideas, their first argument, of course, is a good view from that. I'm hoping that we'll get some information on that. The second is a criticism of the provision that says that if a child or a youth is not raised, and later there's a determination in the juvenile system that the kid is not amenable to treatment. And basically, I think one of the things you're saying about the waiver procedure is we don't really know enough about that to determine whether or not she or he is amenable to treatment, therefore we tend not to waive them and keep them in the juvenile system. That would be okay if someplace further on in the juvenile system, if there's a determination that that kid is not amenable to treatment, that you could then bounce them into the adult system. What's your reaction to that as a proposal for sort of a middle ground on this question?
Well, I try to be basic, so I try to avoid constitutional problems. Not less than overturn the double jeopardy there. It depends how we approach it. And that would be my main fear, is that if there's a double jeopardy problem and there's an equal treatment problem under the point change in the fifth, very practical what you suggest, Representative Foxman, but I would have some constitutional problems in making a practical program that would work.
So that would be some procedure. And another item that they suggest, many other states authorize the extension of jurisdiction over a juvenile to a much higher age than the other years of 19, especially additional years. So you can keep a juvenile in a juvenile setting in this state until the age of 20. Other states go so high as 23. If it's a person that is successfully receiving some sort of treatment, you can extend jurisdiction, keep them in the system. That eliminates the concern, I think, raised by Family Connection that probably if somebody can just refuse to accept treatment in 2 years, they have to be released. You bring this point that you can't put them back into the adult system because that's double jeopardy, that's trying to fight for the same time. What's your reaction to the idea of extending adult jurisdiction in certain cases coming up in discussion? To the age of 23, so you can do that one down.
We're trying to make an improvement in an area that needs to be improved, I believe, and you're offering another practical approach. Right now, if I'm reading this 47 generated correctly, we can keep them in, pardon me, until 18, 1 year after that. So we released them at 19 and last, I believe. If you want to extend that jurisdiction for a longer period of time, what I'd like to see is something offered that resolves the problem. I think this bill that I've offered offers a solution to the problem, and your suggestion is a very practical and actual suggestion that is not reduced to writing for a part to meet a value. The criticism I have of my bill is that it does not address presumptive sentencing of a juvenile who may commit homicide one and have a mandatory minimum of 20 years. Possibly we should wait on that, and I know that the governor's bill and the attorney general's bill addresses the presumptive sentencing. I will say, though, that the other differences that the governor's bill has when compared to this bill, I'm playing with concepts of substantial likelihood, the other than probable cause, and it's getting around to hearing. Getting around to hearing makes sense. I want to say that that's true. But I see the blend of this bill with the governor's bill as offering the best practical solution to the problem today. This bill is, this is why we have hearings and testimony. I believe that a blending of the two bills will best meet the needs of the community and best meet your concerns for the rights of tender youth, Representative Foxman.
Just the juveniles until we deal with human crime.
and that is an improvement. Shifting the burden of care to the juvenile is an improvement over the existing situation. It is an improvement that will not protect victims' rights to such a practical extent. It's what I believe the bringing of this bill will do with the governance bill. In other words, if we shift the burden of proof, we will still, as a practical matter, see very few cases, if any. Certain procedures is a legal concept, it's up to the judge's discretion. And these judges have always exercised that discretion for the benefit of the juvenile. And if you're going to change the standard of proof, it's still their legal right to make that determination. And so, I think this is an area, if you really want to protect someone, this is, and I believe that this is a discretion wherever possible, but I think this is an area where I'd like to see the process be more mandatory for victim protection. Young Stanley was one, but I wouldn't trust the man, I would trust the man making the decision, but I believe that it is still often favored to do now the great majority of things.
Maybe we get to make a difference.
Maybe we go to the decision.
We're doing something that is being done by other states. But for me to identify all the states are exactly precisely how they're doing it. Certainly there will be states that are approaching this more conservatively than we're suggesting, and there are states that go on the opposite end too. But that is a very good resource that you've identified.
Well, I would like to add one thing more. I have talked to quite a few police officers, and they have informed me that some of the most heinous crimes they are called up to investigate are done by MSA group, which we're referring to here. Now, we had the one that in Eagle River is my district, and I'm very well familiar with that group. Also, we had one on the hillside over here a year or two ago. I don't know if you recall, where teenagers involved in that, and trying to burn a house down. But apparently, we've got a problem here, and we're going to have to address the mechanics to it
thank you so much. In conclusion, and I'll leave you, and I thank you for your time. I don't know the Department of Law's position, but if we give the judge the discretion to sentence this man as an adult, we take away the mandatory minimums on the first offense, then we really have all the benefits of what we need, I think, if you understand what I'm saying. And I think the AG's bill will address that point specifically.
One more question before we ask the Deputy Judge. Well, Representative, you said that some states are probably doing things more conservative and some are going the other way. What's the other way in comparison to this?
Well, the other way is all states have had juvenile delinquency acts, probably all 50 states. Some are leaving them in place. Others are changing them. The trend would be to change them. Does that answer your question?
But some states, that maybe a state had a juvenile delinquency act passed in 1920, it's still on the books in that given state. Other states are changing this.
Thank you, Representative. Yeah, I know you had a busy day, and
thank you very much.
We had a deal rescue here for the Department of Law, who also heard the state of education.
Programs, and we feel that they should not be mixed with the other population. If we're attempting to rehabilitate younger, less serious offenders, we think that this group of population should be separated out into a separate grouping and dealt with separately. And so we feel that that part of the bill, which is it is in section one under E number one, is a problem for us in the department as far as continuing, if we were to house these individuals presently under the juvenile correctional area. I think that's the major area. The other area that we have discussed, and I think that Representative Pestinger mentioned it, is that both between the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Law, there has been some discussion about what happens to an individual whose case is closed, is transferred to adult court, and then is either acquitted or, in fact, is not convicted of that offense, but is convicted of a lesser included offense. What happens to that individual? Do they revert back to the juvenile system? do they in fact stay in the adult system? And I think Gail Oretzky is going to have some suggestions in terms of how to deal with that issue. In our position paper, we gave a possibility of a way of dealing with that, which would be to revert them back to juvenile system. That is not necessarily the position of the governor. We did not have an opportunity to finalize a position prior to this setting. And Gail Oretzky has some questions that we ought to deal with that in sentencing versus transferring back to juvenile court. But I do want to bring that up, that I think you do have to deal with the issue of what happens when somebody is convicted of the of a lesser included offense, because I think that's an important issue to deal with. And I'll stop there, and then we can get to some of the questions, one of them being the numbers. The numbers are, I would like to at least say that despite what you hear about juvenile crime, when it comes to serious violent crime, juveniles do not commit the majority of serious violent crimes. In 1981 statistics of the Uniform Crime Statistics, there were 31 individuals in the 16 to 17 year age range that committed unclassified and Class A felonies. 31 individuals that committed unclassified, and that's arrests now too. I would like to point that out. That does not necessarily mean that they would have been convicted of those 31. Those are arrests for unclassified and Class A felonies. There were 31 individuals statewide who were arrested for unclassified and Class A felonies who were 16 to 17 years of age.
Just to work on the statistics a little bit, that isn't an indication of whether they got waived to adult court or anything.
It is
that's
not.
Just arrest. Is there any way to trace those folks? I know those are statistics.
Definitely.
Do we know what happened to those? Were any of them waived to adult court?
There was no way to go back and do that in the present system, because the arrest data comes out of the police departments, and then we do not know until we actually have an individual that is brought before the court. For example, in Anchorage and Fairbanks, the court system, where the majority of criminal activity is in Anchorage and Fairbanks, the court system runs the intake. And so we do not in the department pick up those individuals until after they have basically been brought before the court for arraignment, either in the adult system or essentially arraignment in the juvenile system. So,
but do you know by any chance how many juveniles you get
who
have been convicted of a Class A or unclassified felony?
Yes, I can get that information in terms of how many of the I would like to comment on that, though. There's a real problem in that, and I think Chairman brought this up, is that, for example, we have an individual at McLaughlin who was convicted but admitted to an offense of killing both his parents, but he is actually at McLaughlin for shoplifting. And so it is a very difficult thing in juvenile statistics to determine whether, what offense a kid has actually been convicted of. In other words, he never was convicted. That is not what he's placed at McLaughlin for. He's placed at McLaughlin for shoplifting. And so that if we go back to our admitting offenses at McLaughlin, it does not give you a true picture. And that's the reason in last year's testimony and this one, we tried to use arrest data as a little better and use the model of the prosecutor's office, which is, in the most serious crimes, they feel that they are able to prosecute about 75% of the most serious crimes. And so we were feeling that of the 31 arrested, about 75% would ultimately be prosecuted. But it is hard to say at McLaughlin how many kids actually may have committed more serious crimes.
Well, if you've got an 11-bed secure unit, and you say that's always full, at any given time, we could look at who those 11 people are and have a general picture of what we're talking about. Isn't that right?
Right. And at this period of time at McLaughlin, we run about a dozen individuals in McLaughlin who actually have committed unclassified or Class A offenses. And right now, for example, we have 6 individuals there who have committed homicide. Again, committed homicide, not ever convicted, again, in the juvenile system.
Because they weren't waived.
Right, because they weren't waived.
Can we answer a question for me about the, I don't remember exactly what the procedure is, if they're waived into adult court and convicted, they do or don't go to an adult institution?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is an area that is still up in the air, and I would like to say that in the past, in every instance, they have gone to an adult facility. Majority of times, these individuals have been
17 and a half, oftentimes by the time the court proceedings have been finished, because they take a year. I know we're involved in one right here in juvenile right now, in a first degree sexual assault individual. The trial situation has already extended 6 months and may well go into a year, year and a half. By the time they're finally convicted, usually they're over the age of 18 and transferred anyway in the present system. And we've never had an individual who was convicted under the waiver procedure and then housed in juvenile correction, like this bill would actually do.
But you have had people who have successfully been waived into adult court under the existing procedure.
Yes, there have been individuals. And in fact, Gail Horetsky and I were talking about the only one in the Anchorage area that I am aware of recent years that of heinous crime situation, if you talk about homicide, that was not waived was Cassell. We have recently had tried to waive. I'll put that way, because again, you got to talk to the prosecutor. Sometimes they're not choose to waive. But of those that tried, the only one that was not was Cassell. For example, individual committed the cab murders in Anchorage that some of you from Anchorage may be familiar with, where two cab drivers were brutally killed. That individual was waived to the adult court. Recently, we've had the murder up near Fairbanks with the three individuals involved. Those individuals were recently waived to adult court. And there are others who have been waived. We have had some that have not been waived. But there have been waivers under statute. In fact, when I checked with my staff, these are, again, we don't have a good system. The prosecutors don't have a system on board yet that really can capture all this data. The people in the probation office say there were 16 waiver attempts in the last 2 years, of which 12 were successful. Gail said that the problem with that has to do with we don't know if the prosecutors, where, what process when they're negotiating with defense attorneys and others, do they drop the attempt to waiver. So I don't think that those are good. You can use those as active statistics of how successful the waiver statute is. And Dale and I talked about that, and I think she's right on that issue, because of the nature of the present waiver statute, I think that a term that is not utilized, particularly when you get to some of the class A felonies that are lesser, like robbery and second-degree sexual assault, those kinds of things, I don't think it's even essential as far as utilizing the waiver
statute. I have a couple of questions, Mr. Fleury. You mentioned the program statistics, 31 juveniles. Do you have any statistics on adults that the class A felony or unclassified felony? What kind of a ratio are you talking about?
I don't have that with me. I certainly can get that for you. It's available in uniform crime statistics that is published by the Department of Public Safety.
Maybe 31 sounds like it's pretty high. Well, let me ask you, your position now in regard to your active position. I didn't quite catch it in the first place.
Okay, I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Department of Health and Safety Services.
In your opinion, do you feel that a 16-year-old is got enough chance to know what he's doing? I mean, maybe that's a 64-hour question, but I don't know if that's
yes, I do, and I think that's the reason I mentioned that the department is in favor of the waiver statute. We are not in disagreement with the waiver statute.
I thought they were exactly the same in terms of using 81, the last data.
Okay, and this, again, Mr. Chairman, this bill, I think, was Representative Anderson's bill. And Representative Anderson's bill was much broader than any classified class A felony. It, in fact, included some class C felonies and a number of other things. I'm sorry, that is correct. Keith Anderson's bill is quite a bit different from the bill before the arrest. And this next is the arrest data for 235 individuals versus the 31 that we're talking about.
Well, just on that point, if you look at the second page of that, I'm going to make some suggestions eliminating some class A, class A, class A,
And the second to the last paragraph, the estimate for that year was initially 20 years. I hope you all left it. I think I understand the position, but in the composition of this discussion, we said that the department is clearly in favor of the waiver of traffic.
I see them strengthening the waiver of traffic from the 16 and 17 year olds to commit Class A and unclassified felonies. The department feels that under the present situation, that we cannot continue to manage our present population as it is. We have a number of serious felonies coming through the juvenile area right now, and the jurisdiction is not long enough in order to ensure public safety and relief. It's a good example, and after 3 years, it was not 1 year, it was almost 3 years, but it's still, we do not convince that we can ensure public safety. So, and then the time of other individuals who are present place in the Japanese area for homicide, we will have to release them at either 19 or if we can obtain jurisdiction for another year from the court, which we have an option for in the statute, we will keep them very soon. But in many instances, that type of serious criminal, we feel the serious offender, we feel that we cannot handle the type of stuff and we're releasing those individuals to have to
die. Do you, position papers, do you have a position paper ready to be distributed by an annual official month?
I thought it was coming out of the position, but we were going to have to be distributed to the re-release. I apologize to Chairman, and at least the state has been able to run it back this
time. Yeah, I think it's a good one. It's a good answer to look at the system, though, because I guess there's a few questions here about the Department of System that I'm going to place in the city of New
York. It seems to be hung up in place of the rule of the driveway or someone just saying it's a good way of doing it, but we don't seem to be able to do it.
Some of the similar questions I asked was when the testing here. Are you familiar with this guy with the proposal for the last year to shift the burden of proof in the waiver proceedings? And if you have no idea, I'm coming out of the way to
Yes, I'm familiar with that proposal last year. In discussing this year with the Department of Law and the Public Health Association and the Department of Law, both agencies felt that it would be much sooner and much better to have federal labor statutes that actually we all knew what was going to happen to 15-17 year olds rather than leave it up to the judicial determination. I think that is the problem with the public labor statutes. I think some institutes
we can get you those statistics if you would like in terms of, again, from the report that's available, but the rest for younger
I would like to have it for a simple reason. I like to work with trends, see if it shows anything. On the other hand, if you've got an unclassified felony here, which can get an individual up to 99 years,
In your opinion, do you think that individual is rehabable if this would happen with a juvenile 16? I mean, is he rehabable in your estimation if he's got a 99-year sentence looking at it? Because we have to address the rehabilitation system.
Mr. Chairman, I think that if in fact, I guess that is my point of indicating why I see a problem with the bill of placing these individuals in the juvenile facility. If somebody gets a 99-year sentence, I think that it sort of does not match what the juvenile system has been established for. Oftentimes we sort of refer to it as a reversal of the adult system. The adult system sort of emphasis is protect the public and rehabilitate. The juvenile system, there's been a tendency to say to rehabilitate and protect the public. Not that they don't both go the same, but just that the emphasis is a little different in the juvenile system. Somebody gets 99 years, that's a real tough situation for us to have somebody in the juvenile system for 2 years and they're looking at that kind of sentence. I think that would be very, very difficult in terms of programming for that individual. Very difficult. I think Ms. Oreskes can talk somewhat about the issues that presumptive sentencing and whether that should be applied or not applied to this group. And I would rather have her talk to that.
Mr. Pugh, I'd like to ask a question just before we get to leave the go here. You talk about these facilities with only 11 beds, and you seem to indicate that no matter what we do, the facility is overloaded now, and whatever bill goes in there, whatever system.
McLaughlin Youth Center was originally designed to be a 120-bed facility. It presently houses about 145 individuals. 80 beds of that are cottage program. It's an open facility. 3 20-bed boys units and 1 20-bed girls unit, which are in an open campus setting. And the other beds are in the detention area, which are open bays, and I think if you visit any of the jails, they have open bays, and they're basically open bays which have bunk beds in them, and we attempt to keep the lid on that situation. And juvenile detention area and Anchorage, oftentimes will go as high as 50 boys in that open facility, and there is no other space area available at McLaughlin at this time to house serious juvenile offenders. And it's one of the reasons that the department feels that this issue needs to be dealt with, because we are getting more serious offenders, and we do feel that we've got a situation where we do not have the capability for secure programming of individuals with committed serious crimes.
Are there any private facilities available in the area that could take up some of these lesser security risks? Obviously, if you put 50 people in a
Well, I think that I guess I would have to differ with you a little bit, Mr. Chairman, is that when youth are in the detention area, they're under jurisdiction of the court system, and we are just housing them for the courts, and from that standpoint, my understanding is that the courts have felt pretty strongly that those individuals should be detained in that type of setting until such time that the court disposes of the case. And so I would have to have the court system to speak to that issue. Because both Fairbanks and Anchorage, the court system is basically the gatekeeper of who comes into the detention area. And the department is a support service in a sense to the court. We provide the housing, the court does all the main procedures as well as the 50 different procedures. And my feel is that would have to be worked out together with the court, because in the past the court has been very reluctant to have a secure area for the same use.
You see what I'm doing, I don't really look like a sentence, you always say, hey, no reason. And obviously, something is going to be done to modify the security of the country if you think they're a lot of people.
My
sentence on the problem.
And there is a real problem, Mr. Chairman, just in the sense that the juvenile facility is not designed like the new adult facility is being designed for this type of offender. We do not have individual cells. One unit, as I indicated, we have an 11, and units which have individual places for cells. And the rooms which have four doors and can be secured on the left door. At the back and the extension of the area that's available. And that area is definitely to have to be expanded, or we need to have a separate for children. Our own, the department feels that it ought to be separate, that there ought to be, these units ought to be separated out. And I think that because of the seriousness of the offense, it cannot be mixed with those populations. It could be on the same ground, and utilize the same support facilities and so on, but that there ought to be separate units for the reason.
Does an API have one right next to you there?
I'm not sure of that. It probably, I think it does have some pharmaceutical capabilities, I think.
Are there further questions of Mr. Pugh? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Pugh, for taking the time to come down and enlighten the committee. Is Mr. Price, do you have comments, or is the deal? Well, since we are electronically reproducing this thing, if you state for the record your name, would you please proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gail Horetsky. I'm a representative of the Department of Law and Criminal Division. I've been asked to speak to you this afternoon on the general subject of juvenile waivers. And let me just say on the outset that, in one sense, it's kind of unfortunate that this hearing was scheduled for today, because I have been requested to draft, on behalf of the Department of Law, a juvenile waiver bill, which I have done. And it's now being typed in final draft. We anticipate it would be sent over to the governor today or tomorrow. Depending upon the governor's review time, I would anticipate that he would transmit it to the legislature within the next few days. So you would have sort of an alternate proposal to Mr. Pestinger's bill, and then you would be able to compare the printed provisions and decide which sections you like in which bill. I am quite willing to address what I see as problems with Mr. Pestinger's bill and make suggestions, however, because there are a lot of general policy areas that are certainly you need to discuss in either proposal. We see a number of problems with Mr. Pestinger's bill. The main one, just looking at the face of it, if I could, to begin with, and then I can make additional suggestions. He goes to Section 1, and then he creates a new subsection within Title 12. It says, if a court sentences a defendant to term of imprisonment, the court shall order the defendant to be confined in an institution, and then the person be transferred. Actually, the way it works now is that if an individual, be he 15, 16, 17, 18, if, well, not 18, he's an adult, but 15, 16, 17, for example, if he or she is actually, after a hearing, waived into adult court, that person is immediately transferred to the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections and goes into an adult facility. You do not wait for a verdict of guilty. In other words, once the juvenile court doesn't have jurisdiction anymore, once he's in the adult court, he's in an adult jail. Now, where he's put in an adult jail, whether he's put out of Palmer or Eagle River or Sixth and T or down here in Juneau, wherever, depending on the geographic, that's up to the classification committee, where there's space, what the crime is, all of those kind of factors. But since he is now being transferred to adult court and that adult facilities, and that appears to be working very well, our bill, the proposal we make, is that once jurisdiction is transferred to adult court, either under the, quote, automatic waiver for 16 or 17-year-olds, or under a discretionary waiver, which we're retaining the capability for the court to discretionarily waive people, they're automatically transferred to an adult facility. Now, if in that adult facility the people want to keep them separate, in other words, have a sort of a juvenile block within the facility, that's fine. But that's up to corrections and depends on
you know, there's facilities out there at disposal, how much resources they have, and I'm so frustrated we should have put the note in on that. That's my criticism of this bill, and I think that Mr. Pugh made a very good suggestion, is if this person is serious enough offender, he's committed murder, he's beaten people to death, he's done 6 or 7 armed robberies, do you want him in there? These kids are going to go to shoplifting and joyriding, or something's going to be a problem. I don't think so. I don't think you want to contaminate your sort of treatable people by having these high school offenders in there. And I think that works, and that's not what the block is set up to do. So I would very much echo Mr. Pugh's comments along that line. Looking at section 2 just for a moment, what this basically does is set up a dual system. But it says, the court shall order case closed, the minor shall be prosecuted if the court finds at a hearing. So,
Mr. Pessinger's bill requires a hearing for every case that is to be transferred to adult court, regardless of whether that's under the 16 and unclassified or Class A provision or the not amenable to treatment provision. We strongly disagree with that. If, in fact, you're going to be waiving that child, that juvenile, on the basis of, one, his age, and two, the seriousness of his conduct, then you ought not to have to have a hearing in juvenile court on that issue. What this requires now under subsection A is the minor was 16 or older and probable cause to believe he's committed. Okay, 16 or older, I assume it's fairly easy to discover the child's age or just get a hold of his birth certificate or his driver's license. Probable cause to believe he's committed an unclassified felony. What that means is you've got to have a hearing in juvenile court and you've got to bring in all your witnesses. You know, did you see him run from the alley? Were the bullets in the gun? Did he have blood on his pants? What you have is sort of a mini trial right there in juvenile court. And then what happens? The court finds, okay, probable cause to believe he's committed this offense. The court flips him over into adult court. Well, what do we have to do in adult court? We've got to indict him. So what do you have? A grand jury. What's a grand jury? It's a probable cause determination that this kid committed this crime. So what you're doing is developing a system where we have to have two probable cause determinations instead of just one under the current system. And that seems to me a step backwards. What our bill is going to provide is that if a person is charged with an unclassified or Class A felony and he's 16 or older, he is in adult court, period. He is in adult court. And then what happens is he's indicted in adult court just the way any adult defendant would be. So you have a probable cause determination. We're not doing away with that, but we're only having one, and it's in adult court, and it's either the grand jury or the preliminary hearing, depending on what you use. So that's our criticism of number one. Number two basically restates the current law, and minors not amenable to treatment. The bill that I am proposing that will go to the governor basically keeps that concept, that is, a discretionary order. For example, if you have a 15-year-old who committed several prior felony offenses and then murdered his parents, he's 15, the court still should have the ability to discretionarily waive that person, and that would be under a section similar to section 2 of Mr. Pessinger's bill. What our criticism is that it changes the standard somewhat to say there is no substantial likelihood of rehabilitation by the time the person, the juvenile court, needs jurisdiction over him. That's based on language from other state statutes, and what it's designed to do is ease the ability to waive a serious offender about a juvenile into adult court. The problem is the current way the statute is described. The court has to find, by a preponderance of the evidence, that the jury is true, that the state has to show, that the minor is, quote, not amenable to treatment, end quote. Now, if this person has committed a very, very serious crime that he or she has never before come to the attention of the juvenile facility, you have sort of no track record to judge by. You've never tried to treat him, so you don't know whether he's treatable or not. Under those situations, the court finds it extremely difficult to say, well, there is, he's not amenable to treatment. Because how do we know? He's never tried it. Even though this is a very serious crime, perhaps he or she is amenable to treatment. So almost always, if it's a first offense before the juvenile court, no matter how serious, the court will not waive an individual. And that's what happened in the success case. That 17-year-old boy was not waived because The judge who sat over, presided over that hearing, couldn't find that he was unamenable to treatment. Now, personally, I think you could have made that finding based on the seriousness of the offense, but I wasn't the judge. I didn't hear the evidence. The judge, after hearing all the evidence, said, I can't make that finding, therefore he stays in juvenile court. What we would like to do is propose an alternate standard, which is there's no substantial likelihood that he or she would be rehabilitated. You're still going to have the problem if they've never come before the court before. How can you say? It's kind of a guesswork. But I think it would make it a little easier to waive people in appropriate circumstances. So that's my comment on Mr. Pessinger's bill. Basically, our bill, in addition to what he addresses some things that he does not address. One thing that we say is references to the age of the person refer to the age at the time of the offense, just to make that clear. It's not the age of the time of the trial or anything like that. What we provide is once the person is waived into an adult court, he is subject, if he's convicted for any offense, be it the waived offense or a lesser included offense, he is subject to sentencing as an adult. In other words, if he's waived for first degree murder and he's convicted of second degree or manslaughter, he remains under the jurisdiction of the court and he is sentenced for that offense. But what we do provide to sort of allow the court, the adult court, to take into account the age of the offender as well as the seriousness of the offense and the circumstances is we say that for the first time, he's not subject to presumptive sentencing. In other words, if the juvenile is waived for robbery in the first and he uses a handgun, under adult presumptive sentencing provisions, that person would be subject to a presumptive term of 7 years because he used a handgun. Well, we provide that he doesn't have to get that 7 years. The court can give him 3 years or even probation in an appropriate circumstance. Now, the court can give him 7 years if it wants. It can give him the presumptive sentence. The court's discretion, but it doesn't have to. In other words, you're waiving kids at a younger age, but you still need the court the power to take into account the younger age at the time of sentencing. Rather than transferring back to juvenile court, you see him in adult court, but you temper your sentence a little bit. It's sort of an alternate route to arrive at the same end, which is taking into account the youth, home situation, educational possibilities, rehabilitation, all of those legitimate factors. We also provide that once a person is waived to adult court and convicted of any offense, then he or she will be tried as an adult for any subsequent offense, whether it's waivable or not. Basically, what that means is someone is waived for robbery at age 16. He's given a 2 or 3 year sentence in prison with good time and all of that kind of stuff. Maybe he gets out after a year and a half. Okay, he's still not, he was 16 at the time of the waiver, he's now 17 and a half, he's still a juvenile, but he commits another crime, and say it's joyriding, or maybe something that's not a felony offense, or it's not an A or an unclassified, maybe another robbery or something like that. You don't want that person put back in McLaughlin to hang around with those younger, more unsophisticated kids. This guy has already served time in adult jail. So from now on, he will be treated as an adult for any offense. And if it's a minor offense, he'll get a minor sentence. If it's a serious offense, he'll get a serious sentence. In the discretion of the court. If it's a second felony offense, he will be subject to presumptive sentence. In other words, presumptive sentencing applies to these people except for the first offense. You give them a break the first time around. But second, third, fourth, presumptive sentencing applies just as if they were an adult.
Gail, how do you think that the truth of space requires to the people that are being incarcerated?
Well, we would have them placed in an adult facility, and it may in fact be that you have to increase the adult facility. It's my understanding that the governor has already endorsed the construction of maximum security, so many bed facility. I'm not, that seems to keep going back and forth, but I understand he's endorsed the concept anyway. If in fact that's built and you're able to transfer some of your current adult offenders into this new facility, that should free up some bed space, for example, in Eagle River and Juneau and the current correctional facility, so that we can put these 16 and 17-year-olds in the adult facility.
I would expect that there would be an attempt, or could be, in my opinion, an attempt greater effect put on rehabilitation than these kids, even though it is a rehabilitation, just because of their age. There ought to be a greater expectation considering that these kids could be rehabilitated and somehow freed, even though they are still in the center. And some kind of a progress monitoring system put into effect that somewhere along the line we could test rehabilitation and pull them out of the system rather than a serious commitment.
Well, I don't know that they would necessarily on a first defense be serving that long of a sentence, sir. My experience with the judges, at least in Anchorage, is that generally is not a problem, not on a first offense. A lot of people on first offenses get SISs, and they do maybe 6 months probation, or 6 months in jail, and then, you know, a lengthy probation period. If you're talking about a 17-year-old kid, I don't think your complaint or the citizen's complaint are going to be these kids are in there too long. I just don't think that's going to happen. The court is going to take their youth into account when they're giving a sentence. And I certainly agree with you that it's appropriate to put more sort of rehabilitation effort into these people, no question about it. But there are facilities within the correction system right now where you have sort of intense rehabilitations, and that Eagle River and Palmer that come to mind in terms of having counseling and vocational rehabilitation and university within walls and all of that. That's in place now. We could plug these kids into that. You might have to modify it somewhat, but certainly those concepts are already in place right now for adult offenses. I don't think it would be hard to modify them for juvenile offenses. You may want to have a certain, you know, special wing in Eagle River or something like that, but that would be up to correction. We had initially planned to request that the bill, in fact, require that these individuals be segregated within the correctional facility. In other words, everybody under 18 is over here. And we met with Mr. Andel, Mr. Hugh and I did, among others, and said, this is what we want to do, what do you think? And his reaction was extremely, extremely negative on that. We can't do it, we don't have the facilities, we've got to be flexible. For example, what if one particular juvenile offender is in there for murder and is very, very serious offense, serious disciplinary problems, threatens the other inmates who are older, and this could happen. Some of these juveniles are kids to their age, and they wanted to have the freedom to put an appropriate person in with more hardened criminals if that's sort of the level he's at, or to put him in isolation, or put him wherever they need to put him to serve their population the best. And Mr. Andel assured us that the classification committee would take into account a certain person's views when they did classify him, but that he just couldn't work with a strict, they shall be segregated rule, because he said that doesn't allow for individual citizens. And I guess after I spoke with him, I needed to understand his point. And so we took that to the end.
So you can understand the committee's feelings here. We're talking about, you know, Executive Order 54 at the same time. It's going through everybody's mind, as it is, it should be.
That number doesn't ring a bell, sir. I'm sorry.
That's the governor's order to create a new Department of Corrections.
Right.
And there is legislation bounding around to pull the youth out and leave them, just part of the Department of Corrections. And as you consider all this kind of legislation, if you don't keep that in the back of your mind, you end up trying to get legislation on the books that won't fit into the ultimate system that's created.
That's an excellent point, Mr. Chairman, and that's another reason why we said if they're waived to adult court, then you put them in adult jail. If they're children, Health and Social Services have them. If they're adult, Corrections has got them. You don't have this sort of overlap. Specifically because of that pending reorganization, it's another reason why we just said put them in adult facility.
A couple of questions, Mr. Horesky. How much is involved in getting, how much on your plan there under the governor's bill, and how can we tighten up this waiver provision? This is the big question.
It's a terrible, terrible problem, sir. It really is. I was a prosecutor for 4 years. I know how extremely frustrating this is. The proposal I'm putting into the governor provides that a person can be waived if the court finds, one, probable cause to believe that he committed a serious offense, and two, that there is no substantial likelihood of rehabilitation. And then there are specifically 9 different factors which are listed in the legislation which the court shall look at when determining whether or not there's a substantial likelihood of rehabilitation. They include, just real quickly to run down some of the factors, seriousness of the offense, danger to the public, the aggressive, violent, premeditated, or willful manner in which the offense was committed, whether it was against persons or property, whether it was part of a repetitive pattern, the age, maturity, educational background of the person, success of any previous attempts at rehabilitation, whether jurisdiction can be retained long enough over that person to allow for rehabilitation, treatment resources available for the juvenile justice system, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, the court, on a discretionary waiver, will look at all of these factors and say, considering all of these, is it better for this person to be in juvenile court or adult court? And then it makes that determination. The bill is an attempt to make it easier to waive in appropriate circumstances. It is very, very, very hard to get a juvenile waived under our current system, and it is not for want of trying.
Well, that brings up to my second question, Mr. Chairman. The public, I believe I can speak for the general public, they do not like to hear our judges make a statement like Judge Moody did on one here about a year ago in regard to sexual assault meeting. I guess I made a mistake. You see what I'm getting at? I mean, so that's why I asked the first question. How can, under your present bill, we be assured that we will get a waiver if it can be, can we bank on it?
No, sir. Every time you have a judge making basically a judgment based on discretion, maybe you're going to get some wrong results. My bill doesn't guarantee that a judge is going to make a correct decision in any given case. I can't guarantee you that. No one can. But I can tell the judge what aspects to look at, and I can make it easier for him to waive. But as long as it's going to be a discretionary waiver, you're always going to have the possibility of human error. And it is hard to predict in advance whether someone's going to do it again or not.
Well,
he can look like a good risk on paper in front of you, and 2 months later he can go out and do the same thing.
You come back to your early statement there, you referred once to these poor 17-year-olds. You know, a person can only be killed once, you see. So whether we designate him a 16, 17-year-old or a 25 or 26-year-old, you know, if he is in that frame of mind, you know, we all have to think, to accept that they can only kill once. Now, how poor is he? Whether he's a 16-year-old, a 17-year-old, or what category do we put him in? This, to me, I don't have too much trouble accepting this. You know, that's the way it is.
Representative Lutka, I absolutely agree with you. And under this bill, if he is charged with murder, we don't go through any of the hearing business. Boom, he's in adult court. Now, what the adult court does with him, that's the subject of a sentencing hearing and maybe a psychiatrist report and all of that. You know, we still have to look at what's appropriate. But if he's charged with murder, boom, we're not playing waiver hearing questions. He's in adult court.
Well, one of the individuals involved in the Cassell case, he's out free and clear.
That's right.
And he's nothing but a troublemaker in my district right now.
Well, that's under our current law right now. And that's a perfect example of what's wrong with the current law. I couldn't come up with a better example.
Because what's going to happen, he's going to kill somebody else. Right. That's what I look forward to. Really a tough little individual. He's grown up a little bit since that murder, but he's still around.
Mr. Rescue Counselor, I have a question you would like to make.
You know, there are a couple of statements you made, Gail, that I didn't quite follow. You indicated, first of all, the determination is made, you don't wait for a conviction. And then you objected to this provision in the bill that says that the court finds that in hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So with those two statements, my question to you is, how is it done now? Is it, what kind of a hearing? What kind of process takes place if a waiver is made and a person is transferred to an adult jail? What happens? What is the process?
What happens now, sir, is that if a juvenile is arrested for example, murder, he's taken by the officers over to McLaughlin Youth Center. Mr. Warner is a juvenile intake officer in Denver. Mr. Warner calls up the DA's office and says, Mr. Grandfather, I have a 16-year-old here who's charged with killing both of his parents. I really think you ought to take a look at this one with an eye to adult prosecution. That's how we even find out about it. The juvenile waiver people come to us and say, listen, there's somebody else here you want to look at. Okay, we make a motion in front of the Superior Court to say, this particular boy A ought to be transferred to adult jurisdiction. Then you have a big hearing. At the end of the hearing, if the court finds that he is, quote, not amenable to treatment, unquote, he is waived to adult court and put in an adult jail. There is a hearing for every single waiver known.
And is that the same thing that we're talking about in this bill?
That's right, and that's what Tom is talking about. We're talking about two different kinds of bills. My bill.
I hate the Department of Laws bill. I wrote it, so I feel very proprietary to it. But the Department of Laws bill sets up a dual system. Okay. One is, for want of a better term, an automatic waiver for 16 and 17-year-olds.
So that would eliminate the hearing then?
That eliminates the hearing in juvenile court. You still have to indict them. I mean, you still have a probable cause determination. But that's an adult court. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's on one hand. On the other hand, you retain the discretionary waiver for kids who are not in this class, like a 15-year-old who commits murder, and that follows the same procedure set out here. You have to have a hearing, and that's in juvenile court. Now, if he is waived, then you still have to indict him in adult court. So in that case, you get two probable cause determinations. But it's not an automatic waiver. The interests there are strong enough that we continue to have a hearing in juvenile court.
So it's only those 16 or older who would automatically be
in
adult. Without the hearing. Okay.
It's called a legislative waiver. There are different kinds of waivers, and one is a discretionary court waiver, and one is what's known as a legislative waiver, and it really that's automatic. And this is what's known in the literature as a legislative waiver.
Obviously, we've gotten along to the point where we've got two more pieces of legislation that are flying around that deal basically with the same subject. And I guess the biggest thing we've got in this city, at least to me today, is the knowledge that the governor also has another piece of legislation coming along. So it seems to me like the committee needs to wait until at least that thing gets along before we do anything else on pieces of legislation dealing with this, make sure the bill sounds like this.
Thank you, sir. If I could make one comment, I think it was you, Representative Lisker, that asked a question earlier about other states having lowered the age. I have a book here that surveys all of the other laws in the other states, and I'd certainly be glad to let you have a look at it if you want to. But to answer your question, there are four other states that have dropped the age of jurisdiction straight to 16 for everything. And I can read those to you. There are Connecticut, New York, North Carolina, and Vermont that have just said, the heck with this, we're dropping it to 16 for everything. So the idea of dropping to 16 for serious felonies is not unheard of. In fact, most states do it for serious felonies. Some states do it for everything.
Thank you, Mr. Okay. With that, I think we'll terminate further discussion at HB 109 and table it until further action at some later date. Quickly going to HB 100. Which is an act relating to the power of the chief officer, firefighters, emergency responders. We have a couple of people here today who would like to say something about that, if they haven't already all gone. First on the list is Robert Hayes. Right. Is Robert Hayes present? Robert Hayes, if you take the seat there and take the other, recording this electronically, if you state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is E. Robert Haig. I represent the Alaska State Firefighters Association and the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. Mr. Chairman, I provided the staff with a very brief statement from our two organizations in this bill. I'd like to mention that while our two associations had the meeting in October in Ketchikan, we passed a number of resolutions concerning the fire service. We did not specifically take up any change in or additional wordage as presented before Bill 100. And again, Mr. Chairman might mention, this bill is identical to Senate Bill 24, which we testified on February the 2nd, and of course, last Friday on the teleconference. Our original suggestion before they got into a legal discussion was to change the last two lines to get in regardless of rank, function, or duty being performed. And that was considered by the council in Senate Judiciary on 24. And then we moved into the discussion of felonies and where did it lay into and so forth, and that's out of my field. I'm in a different area. We do have, I have some colleagues here with me from the peace officers, and they made a testimony, and they also gave some very good examples on the telecom, which you might want to hear. And with that, I'll be glad to ask any potential questions or provide additional answers. Thank you.
If I have a question, Mr. Hayes, that we refer to the chief officer's system, but what very factor, what
well, we're moving pretty fast here, but for those who are not chief officers, I'm a little confused about what an emergency responder is. What is an emergency responder?
Representative Arnett, we're talking about a police officer, which is a patrolman, so a trooper and a detective. A firefighter, and that's why we ask for the change in the word, is a person actually physically going out and combating and fighting a fire. Emergency medical tech, or the paramedic, or the ambulance attendant, or by their own. There can be other emergency responders, could be individuals who are assisting in responding to one of these particular situations if you want.
Is the term emergency responder defined anywhere in our statute?
Doesn't talk to I couldn't answer that because I'm on the right side there.
Does this bill, even with your change, would it apply to those emergency responders if they were not in uniform?
I would have to say yes, they would. But again, I don't
think an additional crime or a more serious penalty for causing physical injury to someone who may not be performing any specific duties and may not be in uniform.
There can be people who are not physically in uniform at the time of an injury. And that's why he's got
to come to the
that's the way that I'm sorry I can't answer my question.
Could that be a volunteer fire department member for the way you read it?
Yes.
He's a blue light supervisor, but they're not in uniform.
That's right, but he would be qualified to under firefighter.
Yeah.
In that particular respect.
Yeah, as I read this, this is just about cover anybody that was involved in charge of any of the situation that happened. Electrical thing that I decided to disconnect the power, I would just start to become part of it as being part of the remedy group, I would think.
Or if I volunteered to help in fire control,
that's correct.
And then some of the witnesses.
Because I would understand that if you volunteered and the officer on charge at that time asked you to perform a duty, you would then be charged.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes. Mr. Thompson from the Office of Public Employees Association, and again, for the facility with the Electronic Safety Association, and the procedure being announced, and I'm here.
My name is Lee Paulson. I'm from the Alaska Public Employees Association. We would like to confirm with the committee their intent to include in the definition of chief officers, corrections officers. But in the current definition of chief officers in this section of code, there is some question as to whether corrections officers should be included. However, for purposes of retirement and other benefits, corrections officers are included in the definition of chief officers. There are numerous instances where assault by staff as well as visitors, the same question of facilities occur, and correctional officers we feel should be included under the provisions of this statute.
Mr. Responder, we feels that you're covered under section 8511 and 8190 of the definitions of 38 for chief officers, the public service vested by law with the duty to maintain public order. And make arrests where that duty extends to all sources of living in the civic life and social assemblies. We think that self-authority is already covered. They're very popular.
Thank you, Dr. Steve, authorized to make arrests. When we include public order, there was some question as to whether that included within a section of
facilities. We clearly think that that's covered. However, since you brought the point, I think we are asking the Attorney General's office if that's not covered, but I clearly think they are under the definition.
In the definition for the retirement section, correctional officers are specifically noted as chief officers.
Yes.
they haven't been to do with each other, but we'll ask you to do that with the background, and if they're really dumb,
statewide basis in 1981, there were a total of 235 police officers assaulted in that year, which represented a 12% increase over 1980. 74, or 31% of these, resulted in personal injuries to the officers, the majority of which were caused by hands, feet, and fists. 1982, we have through October, for a 10-month period, a total of 231 police officers assaulted. That appears that that's probably going to be an increase over 1981.
Are there questions, Mr. Turner, Representative Clausen?
Would this include a police officer who is not in uniform?
I assume it would.
Second question.
Representative
Clausen? We dealt with some legislation last year on police officers and making arrests and heard some of the similar statistics. Can you refresh my memory? It seems to me we increased the sentence for resisting arrest or some such. I think it was resisting arrest. Increased the penalty for that specific crime and eliminated a defense for that crime. And again, heard some of these same statistics. Did that bill pass? And can you refresh my memory about that?
I'm sorry, I'm totally unfamiliar.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we did. I remember dealing with it on the floor of the House, at least. I don't remember if it passed the Senate, but I'd like to find out if it in fact passed, because if that passed, we were told at the time that that would take care of this problem for police officers, and now we're coming back and rewriting the criminal law again, and I'd be real concerned with that. So I'd like to, maybe staff will check on that.
Yeah,
resisting arrest, it basically eliminated most of the defenses to resisting arrest, which I've been around police officers when they get in these situations, and that's the most common problem.
It rings in my mind, and I don't know who told me, and I looked around to find the stuff, and it seems to me one of the reasons that this needed to be done was that some trial took place in the last year or so during which they decided that a fireman was not to be treated under this, accepted under this statute for some reason. And I can't just get that all together, but I'll try to find that.
That was another
bill,
so that was an
article.
Okay.
Was it?
Okay. Yeah. I've heard that three times now in support of this legislation. I'd like to see some firm evidence of that. All these rumors going around about what the court's saying in certain cases.
I am doing fine.
I suspect it's similar to what the testimony we heard earlier on how many times students are getting waived. I'd like to see some facts for the thing that we need to look at. Was
there any below?
Yeah, and I guess that maybe some of these questions I haven't been able to answer for it. I noticed in this information that was submitted to the committee by Representative Lockwood that the resolution from the Fire Chiefs Association stating, citing some case, State of Alaska versus Markland, that I don't know, not clear that there's a direct bearing on this bill. I don't know if that's what's behind the bill or whether it's something else that's left.
We have staff here to represent his locker, who's going to make a statement right following Mr. Turner. If there are no further questions for Mr. Turner, perhaps we can hear from representing locker staff and that may answer your questions. If not, thank you, Mr. Turner, for coming down and taking the time to talk about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If you are recording this electronically,